Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Well, this the Chapel Hill cookbook authors are not strangers in Chapel Hill. I've got one of them with me is Morton Neal. And Morton, you're good to come back and be my co-host because you're a frequent guest on this program to talk about cooking and restaurants and
It's always fun to be here with you, D.G.
And you brought someone who we could say is a new Chapel Hillian, but really she's been a North Carolinian virtually all of her life and just visited other places.
Actually, she's been around Chapel Hill for a few years now. No longer a newcomer.
Jean Anderson is a nationally known cookbook author. I think of maybe 20 books. Is it 20 books, Jean?
Have you written? More than.
I don't even keep up with them anymore.
I don't count because I don't want to sound like a hack.
Not just a writer or an editor of cookbooks, but food writer for national magazines and so well respected. Jean has a new book. It's called Love Affair with Southern Cooking, Recipes and Recollections. And before we just jump in to talk about it, I'd have to say it's one of the most fun books to read, even for somebody who isn't going to take the recipes into the kitchen. It's a book about food, and the recipes hold the book together. It's just wonderful.
Thank you.
You don't even need the recipes. However, there's not a single recipe in that book that I don't want to cook.
That's it. Jean, thank you. You brought in for me some Moravian ginger
bread.
Bread in little tiny mini cupcakes. Why do you call it Moravian?
Well, it's a recipe that I first tasted in the Salem Tavern in Old Salem. And I thought it was wonderful. And I was then nosing around the visitor's center, you know, the bookshop area. And I saw this little packet of recipe cards and opened it up. These were old Moravian recipes. And bless Pete, there it was. And so this was quite a few years ago. I was doing a North Carolina portfolio for Family Circle magazine. And we were doing like the coast, the Piedmont, and the mountains. And so Old Salem was the Piedmont. And I reworked the recipe for Family Circle. It appeared in Family Circle together with some wonderful pictures in the Winkler Bakery. And in fact, the bakery did bake it for the photograph, although they don't normally, you know, bake it and sell it at the Winkler.
So you have to, it's Moravian. Winkler did it as a special order for you, but you can't buy it.
Not for me, for Family Circle.
And, right. But to get it now, you have to make it yourself. Now, oh, Jean, you've caught me because there are lots of Moravian recipes, but I can't remember. Surely the recipe for this is in the book.
Oh, absolutely, it's in the book. The one that I take when I do bookstore programs and signings. Normally, it's baked in a big pan, but that's messy. When you go to a bookstore, people are handling books, and you can't just cut it up. So I bake it in these little minis, and that recipe bakes 12 dozen minis.
Oh, well.
Which is a lot.
Well, that's a great thing to take for a church.
But it also freezes well. You can make it. In fact, those had been frozen.
Well, now you mentioned before we went on the air that there is there's always a little secret. What's the secret to the success for the Moravian?
The only ginger in it is finely grated fresh ginger.
What does that mean? I have to say, well, if I were looking for ginger, I'd go try to find a bottle that I would shake.
No. Yep. This is what people call ginger root. It's actually not a root. And you can get it in any supermarket now, and it just makes a world of difference. And you know, the Moravians, who, like the Shakers, were very efficiency-minded. And I just chunk it, peel it, throw it in the food processor, let it rip for 30 seconds, and it's ready to go.
Is it a powder? Does it turn into powder?
No, it's wet.
Where did Moravians get ginger up here?
I think they probably grew it.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, I grew it in New York on my windowsill. You can do it, and they sell it at the Carrboro Farmer's Market.
Are you going to hog those, did you? Are you going to give me one? I know they're way on the other side of the table, out of my reach.
I don't think she brought them to you.
I'm sure she brought me one teeny little muffin.
They're for both of you.
Well, they are fantastic.
Here, you don't have to overcompensate by giving me two. One is fine.
It makes me put in the back of my mind that whenever there is an announcement that Jean Anderson is going to be appearing at a bookstore, I'm going.
Regulator coming up.
Well, Regulator's coming up. When's the Regulator?
Well, it's close to Mother's Day, which is quite a way in the future.
Maybe we can get you back before that comes up.
Let me just say that I kind of want to ask questions about what is distinctive about Moravian cuisine, but there are so many other different varieties of cuisines in this.
There are.
In this, under
well,
the
and, well, and you know, one of the
Southern.
Things that I think very few people realize is that Southern cooking is the most varied of all the regional cuisines in the whole U.S. I mean, you know, you think of New England, and you can name half a dozen. Mm-hmm. You can, you know, clam bake, clam chowder, Johnny cake, Boston baked beans, Boston brown bread, and then what?
Cream pie.
Well, yeah, Boston
cream pie. Is that really
Boston? Yeah,
Boston?
Right. And I guess Parker House rolls came out of the Parker House.
All right, that covers it.
That covers it. But you think of the South, and it's huge. I mean, literally scores and scores and scores of recipes. And the reason, I think, is that it started first with the Spaniards coming into Florida, you know, Ponce de Leon. Then you had the French and the Caribbean settling along the Gulf Coast. You had many different Indian tribes who certainly made a huge contribution. You had the African Americans imported to work the, you know, the plantations. Along the Atlantic coast, sort of from Savannah up past Richmond, you have the Brits, many of whom were aristocratic Brits. You had the Germans coming into Baltimore. You had the Germans and Scotch-Irish and the Moravians coming down from Pennsylvania, down the Shenandoah into upstate North Carolina and upstate South Carolina.
The French Huguenots in Charleston.
And the French Huguenots, absolutely, in Charleston. So, I mean, the contributions are, well, and then the Cajuns, of course,
oh, gosh,
coming
yeah.
into Louisiana.
That's big.
So it's huge. I mean, it's absolutely
so you're,
huge.
I mean, what you're arguing, I guess, is that this has a carryover into Southern literature
Everybody
as well.
Everybody stirred the pot. Mm-hmm. Everybody stirred the pot. People talk about New York being the huge melting pot, and it is. But I think the South is equally so. And it's just the sheer size of the South. I mean, it's practically a quarter of the country.
Well, is it Southern cooking, or is this just a whole bunch of variety?
No, I think it's...
You know, when we talk about race mixing and all of this, and we say either we're a melting pot or we're a big salad composed of...
Well, I think it's certainly they have all stirred the pot and they have all shaped what we now know. Certainly, there's subdivisions. I mean, you've got Cajun, you've got Creole, but
Creole in itself is a mixture. That's
yeah,
what
it
the
is.
Word
it
means.
Is, and you know what a lot of people don't know is that gumbo filet was given to the people down there by the local Indian tribes. I mean, it's nothing in the world but dried sassafras leaves that are ground up, which they had been using to thicken and flavor their stews.
Well, before but, we talk,
well, I want to mention
Morton,
something.
This Morton Neal.
You have noticed the timeline in this book. That's one of the wonderful things about the book. On the side,
talk about it. Yeah, it's a history. On the right hand side, there's a history book of the
yeah,
South and cooking and food and
food events of the South going back to Ponce de Leon.
Ponce de Leon, 1513.
And going up, and you know that covers Coca-Cola and
yeah, coming
all
up
kinds
through
of
2007 and but, Krispy Kreme's new healthy whole wheat donut.
Yeah, it's so rich.
I didn't see the quotation marks there, but
well, it's there in 2007.
I loved it. I mean, I'm sorry to. We've got so many things to talk about. We're going to get off track a lot, but speaking of Krispy Kreme, you had a Krispy Kreme...
backstory, yeah.
Yeah, well, you have the backstory and about how you grew up near the Krispy Kreme...
In Raleigh.
In Raleigh, but the other is to take two-day-old Krispy Kreme donuts...
And make a pudding.
Make a pudding out of it as if Krispy Kreme wasn't...
rich enough.
You take this recipe... Sinful enough, I guess, is the right...
But
thing.
I have to say, DG, that my recipe is not as rich as some, because the majority of them have sweetened condensed milk in them, and mine does not.
Oh,
so that
well,
already...
I'm so proud of you. That's just so great. Speaking of Krispy Kreme, I think maybe the biggest fight my wife and I ever had. We were in Winston, and we went by one of you know, not the original, but the yeah. real big one where they've got fresh Krispy Kremes
right
24 hours a day.
Yeah,
and she said, "Oh, we just got to stop," and I just kept on going. Before it was over, we'd gone 10 miles towards Greensboro. I had to turn around and go back.
Was
and
this
get the
cake donut versus the
no,
yeast donut?
It was all she wanted was the original Krispy Kreme,
yeah.
just like you describe it.
Yeah.
And you said
the honey glazed, yeah.
Very specifically that for this sinful, rich pudding, that it had to be the original Krispy Kreme.
Yeah. Well, I remember so well. I was still in New York then, and when the first Krispy Kreme opened in New York, and it was on West 23rd Street, not too far from where I lived. I was Gramercy Park. And I had been raving about Krispy Kremes forever, and all my New York friends, you know, raced over to get, you know, fresh out of the fryer. And they said, you know, what's the big deal? I mean, they were all cake donut fans, which I, you know, I don't like the cakey donuts.
Me either.
I like Krispy Kreme.
Well, I'm talking to Gene Anderson, and Morton Neal is helping me. Gene is the author of a brand new cookbook. I just got to call it a book about food, A Love Affair with Southern Cooking. And we're going to talk some more about that book and about other things about food after this short break. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Chapel Hill resident Morton Neal tells me that Gene Anderson is a longtime Chapel Hill resident now.
Well,
years, Gene.
You know, I cannot believe this. It's been almost 10.
Oh, come on.
No, seriously, since I left New York. It's true. And I mean, I find that really, really hard to believe. But I do also have to say that my father was here with the university. And so the many, many, many years that I lived in New York, I often came home. You know,
often came back. Tell us, Gene, you talk a lot about your family in the book and your mama who came not from the South.
Or my father.
but who allowed you to use the kitchen if you cleaned it up to cook Southern dishes
that
you came to appreciate. Tell us about your family and why they happened to come to North Carolina.
Okay. Well, let me just start by saying I am the first person on either side of my family to be born south of the Mason-Dixon, and I'm very proud of that. My mother was from Illinois. My father was from Ohio. They met at the University of Wisconsin, married. Then he was on, I think, a Rockefeller scholarship. They lived in Austria for, I don't know, 3 or 4 years. My brother was born there, for which I always hated him. And then they came to Raleigh to NC State.
Were you alive? Weren't you alive when they were in?
No.
This is long before you were born.
I was born in Raleigh after they came back to Raleigh.
And what was your father's academic field?
He was a plant physiologist. And was head of the department and then dean of the graduate school. And then he
at North Carolina State University.
Well, no, he was dean of the graduate for all of them. And then he came over to Chapel Hill and he was vice president working directly with Bill Friday.
Wow. And so he was vice president
in charge of academic affairs.
Of academic affairs. And so then you all lived here in Chapel Hill, or did you stay in Raleigh?
He lived in Chapel Hill from about 1958 or 59 on until his death, which was about 10 years ago.
Wow. And so you have roots in Raleigh.
Yep.
And in Chapel Hill.
Right.
And in the rest of the country and the rest of the South.
Well, yeah, New York, I guess. I've lived in New York longer than anywhere else.
But. And Iredell County and the coast. Now, tell us how you got into this. Tell us your story now.
Well, I went through the Raleigh Public Schools, and my mother, being from Illinois, was a very good cook, but she was an Illinois cook. And my very first bite of Southern school was in the basement cafeteria of the Fred A. Olds Grammar School in Raleigh. And, you know, back then, we didn't have vending machines. We didn't have, you know, you couldn't put in a quarter and get, you know, a cola or cookies or chips or whatever. Everything was freshly made every morning by good cooks back in the kitchen. And I started school early. I started actually at 4. But
now, this was not when we had kindergarten. This was the first grade you started?
It wasn't because I was smart. It was because the school was stupid. They were trying very hard to get two first grades because there were too many kids for one first grade. And they assumed, since I was a faculty brat, that I would be smart. So
they were right.
I was let in. Well, I tell you, it wasn't so much fun when you get to high school and you're still playing with Shirley Temple dolls and your classmates are eloping to Dillon, South Carolina. But anyhow, I did, after I went all the way through public school. Well, anyway, let me go back to the cafeteria, because I was going down the line one day and I'd gotten my chicken and dumplings and my greens. And then down in the dessert area, I saw this wedge of pie that was not like anything I'd ever seen. It was sort of the color of amber, and it was softly set, and it was kind of crackly on top. And I grabbed a piece. And when I sat down, I pushed the chicken and the greens aside, and I dove into that pie. It was brown sugar pie. I had absolutely never had anything so delicious in my life. And that's what started me. I wanted to learn more about Southern cooking. And then as
you said, you thought you're a young 5-year-old thinking, my mama's never cooked anything like this.
Well, yeah, absolutely she hadn't. I mean, she was into gooseberry pie, which I really was not very fond of. Well, and then, as I made friends, I would really sort of finagle invitations to go home from school and play with them. But I had an ulterior motive. I wanted to be invited to stay for supper because their mamas were good Southern cooks. And I might get fried chicken. I might get biscuits. You know, chicken never hit a skillet in my mother's kitchen. She roasted it or she fricasseed it, but she never fried chicken.
And it gives you a unique perspective, because it was like Southern food was other. It was exotic.
It was exotic to me, absolutely. And I've always felt more like the student than the insider. And I think that what I also loved about Southern cooking, there were so many interesting stories. You know, like hush puppies, where did that name come from? And, pine bark stew and cathead biscuits and all of these things. My mother's pot roast never came with an anecdote. It was just really fascinating.
I would say that your book reflects many years of collecting on cards or on notes or something. It's like a scrapbook of stories. When did you start collecting these stories?
I mean, my mother, who had been an academic, but after she married and had children, just became a big club woman. And it seems to me that what they did mostly at these clubs was swap recipes. And the mother never cooked the Southern recipes. She collected huge, huge files full of them from all of her friends. And some of these appear in this book. But I don't know. I then did go north to school and got a.
Now, you graduated from high school in Raleigh. Did you stay in public school?
At age 13? Is that what you graduated?
12 years old.
15.
At 15. And then where did you go to school?
Cornell.
And why did you choose Cornell?
Well, my parents, being northern, thought that it would be good for me to go to school in another part of the country.
Was it out of land-grant tradition, too, as well? Did your dad
Cornell?
Have it? Yeah.
Part of it was, and part of it's private. But anyway, Daddy also wanted both my, since he was then, pretty high up the ladder at UNC, did not want either my brother or me.
Wanted to be out of that system.
Yeah, and also, excuse me, Morton, but did not want us to go to Duke.
I'm used to that, Gene. Don't worry.
No, it's a wonderful
Doesn't hurt
suit.
My feelings.
All right, so it's up there. It's cold. It's,
oh, boy.
Did you feel out of place? Were you a Southerner there?
Oh, yeah. At that time, my accent, you could really cut with an axe. But I really loved it there. I mean, I thought it was great.
And were you studying the
food and nutrition?
Food, or were you studying writing?
Food chemistry, basically, and just very, very hardcore chemistry. And it was like pre-med.
What was your occupational aspiration at that point?
Well, basically, although my advisor did not know this, was to be a food writer. She wanted me to go into research. And actually, my senior year, I was a double major. I was working on my master's at the same time I was getting my BS. And I nearly blew up the science lab. And that was the thing that I thought, I do not have the patience. I do not have the personality to be a research person.
Well, Gene, were you already cooking at the time? Did you cook at home?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I absolutely did.
So you always had a passion for it.
I always did. And I had a mother who encouraged it, who was really very good that way.
And then after you got out of school, where did it take you?
Well, I, of course, wanted to work immediately in New York, but that was impossible. And, I mean, you couldn't just go to New York and get a job. So I landed as an assistant home demonstration agent in Iredell County, which is, Iredell, they call it, which is Statesville, about 3 hours west of here, or was then. And I did not know anything about the 4-H clubs. I did not know anything about farms or farm, life. And it was really trial by fire, and it was total immersion. And
What'd you do?
Well, my job was to teach 4-H Club girls how to cook more nutritious meals, to do demos. I mean, you know, there were clubs that were based in all of the different schools, and you would go around and give programs.
What were they eating? These girls.
Homegrown stuff, but they were getting into junk food. And so my role was really to put them back on the straight and narrow.
They were headed for the Krispy Kreme.
Exactly. Right.
So you would travel around to the different 4-H clubs.
In the county.
They were not organized around schools.
Well, they were. Every school would have the 4-H club, you know, and there would be the girls' division and the boys' division, and I worked strictly with the girls. And, you know, different projects. I mean, I taught them how to sew, which is ridiculous because I'm one who safety pins my hems up.
When I was in high school and junior high, about the same time, we had home ec teachers and shop teachers, but not run by the cooperative or the agriculture extension agency.
The schools really had nothing to do with the 4-H club
other than gave you space to do it.
And usually it was after hours. Kids would stay after school, you know, for the club meetings.
And what did you learn from that experience that you would teach us now in your book?
Well, the main thing was that this was my first opportunity to taste all kinds of Southern recipes. I mean, this was the first time I ever tasted wild persimmon pudding. This was the first time I ever tasted Jerusalem artichoke pickles. And the home demonstration clubs, which were the clubs for the grown-ups, every August was picnic month. And Ardle, being a big county, had, 45 clubs. Therefore, we often had to go to 2 picnics a night. And early on, somebody said to me, oh, Mrs. So-and-so's got the best fried chicken. Mrs. So-and-so's got the best coconut cake. So you would run around, you know, with your plate and get all the best stuff first. So, because if you didn't, I mean, you didn't get it at all. But I worked with a lot of these women. I mean, I did work with the grown-up women as well as with the, you know, their daughters. And I really learned so much. I would say that this was my basic education in Southern cooking.
Jean Anderson is the author of A Love Affair with Southern Cooking. She's a Chapel Hill resident. Morton Neal and I are talking to her about her book and about how she got there. We'll continue that discussion after this short break. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Morton Neal, my favorite co-host and guest, the author herself of much writing about cooking and about enjoying other people's good cooking as she visits restaurants and other places throughout this region. And I are talking to Jean Anderson, who has written a wonderful book called A Love Affair with Southern Cooking. It's a book of recipes, but it's also a book about stories about food, about the history of North Carolina and the South. Wonderful book.
Thank you.
I'm trying to figure out how you got there, and you told us that along the way you stopped in Ardle County to work essentially for what we call the Agricultural Extension Agency, now Cooperative Extension,
yes.
This wonderful thing that we have in North Carolina where we send people out just to work with other people, and you in food. But how did you get out of a career in the cooperative extension service? Because people spend their lives
yeah,
working
there.
Yeah,
they do. But I'd always wanted to write. And back to Cornell, after I almost blew up the lab, unbeknownst to my faculty advisor, I switched my final semester and started taking all the writing courses. I didn't take statistics and all of these other things that I was supposed to take. So
let me just say, this is just totally off the subject, but we think of Cornell as being a great writing school. Robert Morgan, a North Carolinian, is a member of the faculty at Cornell.
Yeah.
Teaching writing. So you had good teachers, I guess.
Yeah, I did. Absolutely. So I've always written. And then even when I was in the county, I would find, you know, a particularly talented 4-H Club girl. And I would write an article for, remember, what was the name of the one that Clarence Poe started out of Birmingham.
Progressive Farmer?
Yeah, Progressive Farmer. I wrote stories for Progressive Farmer, and there was another one that came out of Tennessee someplace called Farm and Ranch.
Well, tell me I'm so sorry to interrupt you, but this is so important to me. But now, here you are, young woman, working in the Cooperative Extension Service, and you aspire to write an article for a fairly prominent magazine. Mm-hmm. How'd you do that?
I guess, was very aggressive. But I would, you know, I would...
You just sent it in?
Yeah.
And I even wrote for
Country Gentleman and also for Farm Journal.
You know, they probably didn't have a lot of people in her situation that were writing about
yeah,
it
well, in,
but,
in the field.
Morton would appreciate this, maybe... not quite as much as I do, but I deal with so many writers who write good things and try to get it published, and it's just they run into all kinds.
But are they writing fiction or are they writing nonfiction?
Well, fiction, of course, is virtually impossible. Virtually impossible.
Yeah.
But nonfiction as well, people who are writing about good topics and just don't know where to send it.
Yeah.
And even when they do know where to send it, they get these curt
replies
back.
Well, I think the main thing that you have to do is know your market. I think a lot of beginning writers think that, I mean, they'll submit it one place, really not knowing the kinds of pieces that that particular magazine wants. And then if they get a rejection, they'll spin it around and send it somewhere else. And you can't do that because every magazine has its own identity and the types of things that it wants.
Then did you have a sense of that from your academic training from the very beginning?
Yeah, I think I did, absolutely.
Well, I'm sorry, I did interrupt you, and you're telling us about Progressive Farmer is one of the first big magazines, and
yes.
Then you had the courage to send articles other places, and they took off.
I remember the food editor there was a charming lady called Miss Sally Hill, and she took an interest in me for some reason. And
you saw your way ahead at that time.
And then, I was only in the county for less than a year, and then I was brought into the state office in Raleigh, and I was made the first woman's editor, and my job... was to go
Women's editor of what?
Agricultural Extension Service.
Okay.
And my job was to go all over the state covering activities of the farm women and the farm girls, and then write for newspapers, magazines, television, and radio.
You were the in-house publicist for the Agricultural
exactly.
Extension Service.
And I also worked on a lot of the bulletins, you know, that they
so
do.
So you had transformed yourself from the regular extension agent to a writer, to a publicist.
Yeah. And I.
And how did that lead to writing for the big magazines?
Well, because I was there for, I don't know, about 3 years, and then I spent 1 year at the Raleigh Times as the woman's editor. And then I decided, I think I'll go to Columbia, and get a master's in journalism, which I did. And straight out of Columbia, I was hired by the Ladies' Home Journal to be,
Is that what you envisioned for yourself when you went to Columbia?
Not really. I mean, I sort of wanted to be a big feature writer. But back then, you had to have worlds of experience before they would allow you to write, some big feature article. I really wanted to do the profiles for How America Lives. You know, we would do these, go and live with a family for practically a month, and ruin their lives, wreck their houses, remake their daughters, all of this. But if the story was Southern... there were always, every department had a part in the...
This is, we're talking to Jean Anderson, and she's talking about, this is your first job out of Columbia
and
you're as a writer for Ladies' Home Journal.
Well, no, I started in the test kitchen. It was that Cornell degree that impressed them a lot more.
Oh, wow, so you got in the door.
I got in the door because of my Cornell.
Now, they knew you were a writer, so they knew you aspired.
Yeah,
you aspired to do more.
Well, yes, and also because Bruce and Beatrice Blackbar Gould, who were the co-editors-in-chief, had also come out of the Columbia J School. So they knew. But I started in the food department. And
what was the test kitchen like at Ladies' Home Journal?
it was manic. The interesting thing is, and I probably shouldn't say this, although I guess it doesn't matter because the principals are no longer on this planet. What the food department was also responsible for was to cook the meals for the editors-in-chief who had an illegal apartment in the top of the music hall building.
Illegal, meaning that it was...
It's against ordinance. They were not supposed to be living there.
And also probably living, it was an expense, a business expense.
Well, absolutely.
For their living.
And they were...
Statute of limitations has run.
At that time, Curtis Publishing Company, which owned Ladies' Home Journal, was split between Philadelphia and New York. The Philadelphia office was considered the literary office. The New York office was considered the sweatshop. I mean, it was called the workshop, but it was, you know, food, fashion, interior decorating, all of that. But the food department, the Goulds were in residence 2 days a week, usually Tuesday and Wednesday. And the very first week that I was there, I was told to stay and cook dinner for the Goulds. And they didn't eat until around 9:30 or 10. And they had very limited palate. And the thing that I was to do the first night was veal scallopini. And in the test kitchen, we had these matched salt, pepper, and confectioner sugar right up on the stove. And I grabbed, and I was ready to salt, and I realized that I had grabbed the sugar. And I thought, well, if this is a firing offense, I don't want to work for this magazine. So I sugared the scallopini. And the next morning, the food editor called me in her office and tears running down her face. And I thought, oh, my Lord, this is a firing offense. And she closed the door and she said, I have to read you a memo from Mrs. Gould, who was really God at the magazine. And it said, whoever cooked for us last night is never to cook for us. And needless to say, I was hated in the kitchen because they thought the way to get ahead was to cook beautiful food. I mean, it's like if you type too well, you'll never be anything but a secretary. So I was given an office and I was given a typewriter.
So the message is put sugar in the boss's food.
Right.
Morton Neal and I are talking to Gene Anderson.
I'm not talking. I'm just listening. Having a great time.
Morton and I are listening to Gene tell great stories, some of which are in her wonderful new book, A Love Affair with Southern Cooking. We'll be right back to talk to Gene some more after this short break. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Morton Neal, you said we're listening.
We are listening.
Gene Anderson, as she tells us great stories.
Aren't we lucky?
We really are. And the stories are only a piece, are indicative of what the reader of A Love Affair with Southern Cooking, her new book, gets from reading that book. But tell us more. Tell us your favorite stories, Gene Anderson.
Well, okay, as I had said, we did this How America Lives story, and if the story was Southern, I was usually the one who was set to do the food angle, you know, the Southern food
angle. This is at Ladies' Home Journal, and this is a feature.
How America Lives was a huge, huge, huge feature that went on for years and years and years.
And it was one of those favorites that people who read Ladies' Home Journal back then will remember.
Absolutely, they will.
And for those of us who didn't read Ladies' Home Journal, it's just you would go live with the family and then you'd write it up.
Not physically live with them, but you would just go and stay in the area.
Uh-huh.
And
get to know that family as well as you could in that short time. And then what would be the point of that?
Well, just to profile sort of a prototypical American family. And, you know, researching and finding these families. I mean, we had a whole department that did nothing but scout for typical, you know, good subject matter in How America Lives families. One of the ones that we featured was a debutante in Richmond, Virginia. We had tried to do the St. Cecilia Ball in Charleston, and they just gave us the back of their hand. So we settled.
Why are we not surprised?
Right. So we settled for Virginia, and the subject was a descendant of one of Virginia's many U.S. presidents. And I remember being down on the plantation and having lunch with the girl's mother. And we were sitting in this very grand dining room, very grand silver service, very grand china. And out came a bowl of amber broth. and with little shreds of julienne white meat in it, little crescents of celery, little dots of tomato. And I said, oh, this is delicious soup. And the hostess said, soup, soup, this is Brunswick stew. And I said, oh, good heavens, it's not what I know as Brunswick stew at all. And she said, I know, dear, you're from North Carolina. You make it with potatoes. And I felt like saying, and butter beans and chicken and tomato and onions and a lot of other stuff. But there were many, many experiences like that.
What did you learn from that? What was the learning lesson from that?
Oh, well, you know, the FFV attitude, I would say. But the thing that was really great, because throughout my years at the Ladies' Home Journal, and then, you know, as I became a freelance writer writing for Gourmet and Food and Wine and all the others, I would be sent all over the South to profile either home cooks or chefs. So this allowed me to travel in states that I probably never would have been in. And in the book, I concentrate on the 11 southern states where I've spent the most time, and that would be Maryland, Virginia, the two Carolinas, Georgia, Panhandle, Florida, really, Alabama, Mississippi, Louisiana, Tennessee, and Kentucky. And I've spent a lot of time there, both with good home cooks and, you know, interviewing chefs. And many of their recipes are here, but also a lot of the experiences, you know, snippets of gossip, backstories on products that came out of these states, like Tabasco sauce.
And all the conflicting stories, yeah. I've noticed, like the Brunswick stew, you have one from Brunswick County, Virginia, and then Brunswick,
right.
Georgia. So,
there are
lots of stories about almost every recipe in here.
Yeah.
Well, Morton, thanks for bringing that up, because there are all kinds of stories from Coca-Cola to Pepsi-Cola to Royal Crown Cola, Knee-High, Cheerwine, of those. The peanut story, I didn't realize that we've got at least
the
three that I can remember.
Yeah, all of
different
them.
Hams, how to, all of these stories
absolutely
are great, even though they don't necessarily take you into your own kitchen. Those are great. The other thing, and we're hurrying because we're almost out of time, I just had to say this, that the stories are from your experience, and a lot of your experiences in Chapel Hill and in Raleigh, and so the dominant, I mean, you could almost repackage this thing and say Chapel Hill cookbook or Chapel Hill experiences, everything from
Mama Dip.
From Mama Dip to Bill Smith's
fried chicken.
I've gotten Martin Neal's fresh fig ice cream.
Bless your heart. Thank you.
And from everything from the deer eating food out of your backyard, and the question of whether or not that deer could be appropriated for venison.
Oh, I hope not. This is a gorgeous white deer, and I love.
You've got a white deer in your backyard.
I do, absolutely. And I hear there's one over at Carroll Woods. I can't believe it's the same albino deer.
Well,
it's beautiful to see. I saw it just this morning down in the woods.
Let me ask this. I think we got time for this question, Morton. How does you've heard my sort of feelings about this book and how it fits in for me as a man who doesn't cook very often, but boy, is this book fun to read. How does this fit with cookbooks that you've reviewed and written and seen?
Well, it's got everything. It has very accurate recipes that Jean writes in a way that's easy to follow. She's got the stories about the personal stories about the recipe. She's got the factual history. It's just the richest cookbook I think I can think of.
Well, I thought of it, and I don't mean to just pander to Jean, and since she's been good enough to come and share those
stories.
Since
I brought you some gingerbread.
You brought me gingerbread. I'm a cheap payoff. But I think that you look at a book, and I always look, who can I give this book to? And most books you have to if you're careful and if you're considerate of the person you're giving a gift to, it's just like a puzzle. Well, this book is good for everybody. I mean, it's a book that I could give to the most, you know, the roughest man. I could give it to a real good cook, or I could give it to a woman who doesn't aspire to be a cook at all. She'd have fun reading it. I mean, that's...
And whether you're a Southerner or not, you'll love it. But it makes me really proud to be a Southerner.
Yeah, it makes me proud
too,
to be a Southerner.
Me too, and I consider myself a Southerner, although my roots are certainly not.
Well, we do have this leftover pride that makes us want to think that we're the best.
Yeah.
And we may or may not be, but around here, you better agree that we're pretty good as Southerners. And this reinforces our pride and where we come from. Jean, you've written more than 20, you say countless cookbooks, but With this one, is this the capstone of your career, or are you going to do more?
I'm going to do more, definitely.
What's on the table now?
I'm superstitious. I really, my agent is now shopping a book, and we'll see what happens.
Can you just give us a hint?
No.
No, I mean, is it a cookbook, or is it a cookbook?
Sure. It's a cookbook.
Well, since she's done the definitive Portuguese cookbook and German cookbook, you know, it's probably going to be...
And basic cookbook.
What, Antarctica or something completely from left field.
Yeah.
Well, Morton, thanks very much. Jean Anderson,
thank you.
Thanks to all y'all for listening. We'll be back same time tomorrow.